certain he was going to throw her off. Even though Glory had reassured her that Merrick would never red-light someone he'd paid good money for. Then, as they approached the outskirts of the next city, Merrick pointed out houses with boarded-up windows and bread lines outside churches. He made sure she saw the closed signs on warehouses and the hobos along the railroad tracks. Men and women, young and old, gathered around fires built in trash cans. "People are starving out there," he said, "so you might want to remember how good you've got it. The promise of 3 square meals a day is the biggest reason some people join the circus these days." The morning after a show in Massachusetts, during which Lily got through her act without running out of the tent or having anything thrown at her, Merrick called a taxicab for her, Glory, and himself. When Lily asked where they were going, Merrick said he wanted to show her a place called Danvers State Hospital. In the back seat of the cab, Lily paid no attention to the fact that it was her first time riding in an automobile. The only thing she wanted to know was why Merrick was taking her to a hospital. Was he going to let doctors poke and prod her to see if she was normal? Was he going to sell her to someone who wanted to pickle her body parts and put them on display? She looked up at Glory with worried eyes, her fingernails pressed into her palms. Glory patted her arm and said everything would be fine. 20 minutes later, they arrived at a castle-sized stone building with what seemed like 1,000 windows and steep roofs. They entered through a set of giant doors into a foyer and followed a nurse into a long hallway. The hallway was empty and quiet, except for the clack-clack of the nurse's white shoes. The farther into the massive building they went, the more Lily worried Merrick was going to leave her there. To calm herself, she made her feet go in step with the nurses. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. As they neared the end of the first long hallway, she heard a low murmur, like 100 voices talking in the distance. Then it grew louder and louder. When they reached a set of thick double doors surrounded by rubber strips, the nurse stopped and smiled sympathetically at her. "Now, it gets a bit unruly in here, but don't worry. You won't be staying in this area. Is it all right if I call you Lily?" Lily's heart skipped a beat, then thumped hard and frantic in her chest. She gaped up at Glory, suddenly trembling. "That's not what we're here for," Merrick said to the nurse. "We're looking for a relative." "Oh," the nurse looked at Lily again, confusion written on her face. "I'm sorry, I thought..." "You thought wrong," Glory said. Lily went limp with relief. Merrick wasn't leaving her there after all. The nurse nodded and unlocked the door. Before they even went through to the other side, Lily clamped her hands over her ears. What she thought was talking was wailing and crying and shrieking. The room was full of women in gray gowns with scraggly hair and scratches on their faces and arms. Some were strapped to their beds, and one of them screamed for help over and over. The room smelled like old urine and spoiled food. Bugs scurried up the windowless walls. A woman with a bloody nose smiled and came toward them. Lily edged closer to Glory and kept her head down, her eyes on the nurse's feet. After leaving the frightening, noise-filled room, they passed through a short hallway into another area, this one quieter, with women lying in beds and staring at the ceiling, reading or talking in small groups. The nurse stopped in the aisle and addressed Merrick. "Anyone look familiar?" she said. Merrick scanned the room, then shook his head. "Not this time." Afterward, in the cab on the way back to the train, he said to Lily, "Do you know why I took you there?" Lily, who was leaning against Glory in the back seat and trying to forget what she'd seen, shook her head. "Because I want you to know, if you try to run away, chances are you'll end up starving and homeless, and the cops won't waste any time sending you to a place like that, or worse. That's the first thing you need to remember. The second thing you need to remember is that I visit orphanages and asylums all the time, looking for my next act. Christy the Pinhead came from the Waverly Hills Sanatorium in Kentucky, and I discovered Aldo the Alligator Man in Willard State. So, if you give me a hard time about doing what you're told, having you committed would be a piece of cake. Lily said nothing and stared out the window. It was pouring outside, the green and brown smudges of trees and electric poles blurring past the rain-streaked glass. The clouds hung low and heavy, like ashes in the sky. She tried counting the trees along the side of the road, but couldn't see past her tears. The world was nothing like she imagined, and she would have given anything to be back in her attic room, even if it meant dealing with Mama. A surge of homesickness plowed through her, so strong it nearly made her cry out. Later that night, as Merrick snored in the bedroom, Glory and Lily sat on the couch, talking about the visit to the hospital. "He's right," Glory said. "You're better off with us, even though it's not the easiest life sometimes. With the circus, at least you'll have a place to lay your head at night. 3 square meals a day, a chance to see the country, and friends who look out for you." She gave her a smile that looked sad and forced. "And for the most part, you'll be treated like a person." Lily was glad that Glory was trying to make her feel better, but she couldn't push the images of the women in gray nightgowns out of her head. Visiting the hospital was going to give her nightmares for sure. What kind of place was that? What was wrong with those women? "Danvers is an asylum for crazy people. You know, people who don't know the difference between what's real and what's not. But some people are sent there because their families want to get rid of them. Like my brother, Victor. My parents put him in a place worse than that."
"Why? Is he crazy?"
Glory shook her head and began picking at the tiny balls of fuzz on her skirt. "No, he's not. My parents left him there when he was 5, because some people think when a person looks different on the outside, they're different on the inside, too." She looked at Lily. "But we know that's not true, right?" Lily nodded. After showing Lily the breadlines, the hobos, and Danvers State, and making sure she understood what would happen to her if she misbehaved, Merrick allowed her to walk the lot alone in the evening. When the shows and concession stands were shut down and the big top was empty. But only if the train wasn't loading up to move on to the next destination, and they were far enough away from the nearest village so the townies wouldn't see her for free. Glory thought it would be a good time for Lily to start making new friends, because once the business of the day was over, everyone was ready to unwind and have fun. Maybe she could visit Mrs. Benini or ask Penelope to introduce her to Elizabeth Webb's children. But Lily had other plans. She wanted to find the animal tents, or what Merrick and Glory called the menagerie. On her first night of freedom, after Merrick and Glory took a cab into town to go to a club, she stepped out of the sleeper car, wearing a pleated dress and black Mary Janes, one of several outfits from the Monday Man. The sun was setting in the August sky, coloring the clouds purple and pink and orange, and the first stars appeared in the distance. Crickets chirped in the long, dry grass surrounding the dusty lot, and the dark shapes of birds flitted through the dimming light. It felt strange and a little scary to be outside without Glory or Merrick, so she stayed near the car for a few minutes to build up her courage. Outside the neighboring passenger car, 4 men in polo shirts and pressed trousers set up a table and chairs while a pretty blonde came down the steps carrying a deck of cards and 2 bottles of brown liquid that looked like whiskey. Another woman called out from an open window to ask how many glasses they needed. The men and women were thin and beautiful and graceful, like the ballerinas Lily used to read about in her books. Glory said they were the trapeze artists. When Lily felt brave enough, she moved away from the car and made her way along the length of the train. After passing the trapeze artists in another passenger car, She stopped to pet three goats nibbling on weeds near a telephone pole. Were they the goats from the boxcar where Merrick had locked her in a cage? Had they heard her screaming and crying? One of the goats lifted its head and rubbed its face against her hip, then went back to eating. Another came over and nibbled gently on the edge of her dress, wagging its short tail. The third one sniffed her shoes and socks and legs, then licked her hand with its scratchy tongue. It was almost as if they were saying, "Yes, we know who you are." Glory said the goats were allowed to wander the lot during off hours because, according to Mr. Barlow, they brought good luck. She also said circus people believed the color green and whistling in the dressing tent were bad luck. A bird flying into the big top meant death for a performer, and the trapeze artists and tightrope walkers sewed crosses into their costumes to keep from falling. Lily wondered what Mama would think of the circus performers using crosses that way. Mama said people were put on earth to serve God, not the other way around. So why did the performers think he would keep them safe? Thinking of Mama made her stomach hurt, so she pushed her from her mind, gave the goats another scratch, and kept going. What seemed like a thousand different noises floated out the open train windows, each sound changing and blending into the next as she passed, until it faded and dissolved altogether. A tinny voice on a radio, someone singing, people arguing, a harmonica, a man yelling, a dog barking, coins clinking, laughter, clapping, triumphant shouting. Farther along the tracks, a scratchy up-tempo tune came from the open doorway of a boxcar, the loudest music Lily had heard so far. She slowed. Was someone having a party? Dolly, the world's most beautiful fat woman, and Penelope, the singing midget, sat on wooden crates inside the boxcar, laughing and fanning themselves with paper fans. Wearing a feathered headband and a sequined blouse, Dina, the living half-girl, smoked a cigarette on top of an overturned wine barrel while talking to Spear, the living skeleton. Ruby and Rosie laughed and danced with Aldo the alligator man and two midgets, all four drinking from brown bottles. The twins wore long beaded necklaces, grass skirts, and nothing else, their bare breasts bouncing up and down in time with the music. Lily dropped her eyes and walked faster, hoping no one noticed her. A gathering of men in dirty clothes huddled some distance from the train, smoking and passing around bottles. Inside another open boxcar, a dwarf sang and played a miniature guitar, while Hester the monkey girl laughed and watched Magnus the world's ugliest man trying to teach his dog to play dead. Stubbs, the smallest man in the world, sat on the lap of Belinda, the woman with two bodies and one head, a hardcover book in his tiny hands. Hester caught sight of Lily and called out, asking her to join them. Lily smiled, shook her head, and kept going. For some reason, she wanted to be with the animals more than the people. She couldn't describe how she felt about the animals or why she had such a strong need to see them, because she didn't understand it herself. But it was one of the reasons she was brave enough to venture out for the first time on her own. Maybe she was drawn to them because they understood what it was like to be locked up, with no control over what happened next. Maybe it was because her cat was the only one who had never let her down. Or maybe her love of animals was part of who she was, like the way her left foot turned in slightly, the way her fingers were long and thin, and the way her skin was white as snow. Whatever the cause, seeing the baby elephant and the other animals was the only thing she cared about right now. When she finally reached the animal tent, she slowed, suddenly unsure. What if someone yelled at her for being there? What if they told her to go away and not come back? Then she remembered nearly everyone was done for the day, resting up for tomorrow and relaxing in boxcars and open tents, looking for relief from the heat. Hopefully, no one would be inside the menagerie at this hour. She took a deep breath and slipped in through a side flap, staying close to the shadows. On the other side of the tent, the elephants loomed large and gray, like dark mountains against the canvas. Across from the elephants, zebras, horses, and giraffes stood behind low ropes, sleeping or chewing hay. Camels and llamas lay in a circular bed of straw in the center of the tent, and wagon dens with lions, chimps, and bears lined one wall. The sweet-sour tang of hay and animal dung filled the air, and the only sounds were munching, snorting, thumping, and shuffling. With every sense on high alert, Lily slowly moved through the aisle and approached the elephants, stepping as lightly and quietly as she could until she reached the first one. She tilted her head back to stare up at the massive creature. It gazed down at her with amber eyes, a low, rumbling noise vibrating deep in its throat, like the loud purr of a colossal cat. The elephant was mottled and gray, wrinkled and cracked and furrowed from the top of its head to its enormous legs and platter-sized feet. Its toenails were as big as potatoes. Dark swaths of green ran across its ears and knees, like the mold on the bars outside Lily's old bedroom window. Black hairs and deep ridges lined its trunk, and the tops of its ears looked thick and rubbery, then grew thinner and thinner until the bottoms resembled a tattered old leaf. The only thing between Lily and the elephant was a rope, hanging across the front of the two-sided stall. A heavy chain wrapped around the elephant's back ankle, then attached to a thick stake in the ground. Looking up at the powerful beast, the walled-in feeling of being locked in her room returned, and the heavy, horrible ache of missing home. The sensations were so strong, they nearly brought her to her knees. It was almost as if she could feel the elephant's misery, like she had with the lion, except this time there was something else, too, something that felt like tenderness. Was it possible that this powerful animal cared about people, even after everything they had done to it, even after they had caged it, tied it in ropes and chains, and forced it to perform? Lily's eyes grew moist. More than anything, she wanted to go into the stall and comfort the elephant, to stroke its head and explain she understood what it felt like to be held prisoner, and to still love someone who hurt you. But she didn't dare. She moved along the front of the stalls to the second elephant, which seemed even bigger than the first. This one looked half asleep, its long lashes drooping, its eyes almost closed. She kept going and stopped in front of the third elephant, lying on its side in the straw. Next to it, the baby elephant stood picking at a pile of hay with the end of its little trunk. Lily gasped quietly and put a hand over her mouth. The baby was even more beautiful up close. When it saw her, it lifted its trunk and reached toward her, a finger-like lip at the end of its trunk wiggling and moving. Lily smiled and held out her hand, hoping the baby would come closer. But there was a chain around its hind leg, and it couldn't move forward. Suddenly, the mother elephant startled, sat up and leapt to her feet, faster than Lily thought possible. Lily scrambled backward, her heart racing. "Hey!" a voice yelled, and a boy tumbled between the mother's tree-sized legs and fell in the straw between her feet. It was the boy she had seen with the baby elephant on her first day, the one who waved at her and wanted to help when Merrick dragged her away from the freak show. He scrambled to his feet. When he saw Lily, his eyes went wide. "What the hell are you doing in here?" he said. Heat climbed up Lily's cheeks. She thought about running, but she was spellbound by the elephants and didn't want to leave. Before she could decide what to do, the baby elephant reached for her again. The mother held the baby back with her trunk, keeping her eyes on Lily and trying to push the baby behind her. She looked like the same elephant Lily had seen tied to ropes in the half-open barn, the one the men were trying to teach new tricks. The boy came out from beneath the mother elephant and put a hand on her giant wrinkled leg. "It's okay, Pepper," he said to the mother elephant. "Back. Get back, girl." Pepper stepped backward and grumbled, a deep vibrating sound in her throat. Then she lowered her head and checked to make sure her baby was okay, examining its ears and legs and belly with her trunk.
"That's it," the boy said. "Steady, girl. Steady."
He patted Pepper's leg, then moved toward Lily, frowning and brushing straw from his clothes.
"What are you doing in here?"
he said again, this time with less irritation. She swallowed, searching for the right words.
Would he get her in trouble, or would he be nice?
Maybe he was wishing he'd never waved at her, now that he'd seen her up close.
I just wanted to see the elephants, she said.
He put his hands on his hips.
You know these are wild animals, right? They can be dangerous. You can't just come in here whenever you want.
I'm sorry, she said, and turned to leave.
Wait,
he said. She faced him again. To her surprise, he was grinning.
I thought you came in here to see the elephants.
She gave him a weak smile, relief washing through her.
You want to meet them up close? He said.
She nodded.
Well, come on then, he said. Crawl under the rope.
Quivering with excitement and nerves, Lily did as she was told. When she was on the other side, she stayed close to the rope. The boy patted the mother elephant's leg.
This is Pepper. She's 5 tons of pure talent.
He gestured for Lily to move closer, and she edged forward.
Pepper, someone is here to meet you.
Pepper gazed down at Lily, the baby huddled between her legs, her giant ears fanning back and forth.
Steady, girl,
the boy said, then to Lily.
Put out your hand.
Lily extended her hand, and Pepper reached out with her trunk, the rubbery, finger-like lip tracing the inside of Lily's palm. Lily could hardly believe what was happening. Her heart raced with excitement. Pepper sniffed Lily's fingers, as if checking to see if she could be trusted, then lifted her trunk, whooshed it past Lily's face, and snuffled her cheek. Lily grinned and shivered, trying not to move. Then Pepper grasped Lily's thumb with her trunk and shook it, and Lily laughed.
She likes you, the boy said.
Speechless, Lily couldn't stop smiling.
Guess how old she is, the boy said.
Lily shrugged.
10? Nope, she's 34.
Pepper let go of Lily's thumb and opened her mouth in what looked like a smile. The baby came out from between her legs, and Pepper started to sway, keeping time with the movement of her trunk. The boy urged the baby forward and told Lily to come closer. Lily hesitated and looked up at Pepper, unsure.
Don't worry, the boy said. They trust me. My father is the boss elephant man, the supervisor of the pachyderms. He can shoe horses, drive a 10-horse team, lay out a canvas, and clown if he has to. But mostly, he takes care of the bulls. He feeds them, waters them, and checks for injuries and sickness. He helps the trainer and the veterinarian, too.
Lily raised her brows.
Pachyderms? A pachyderm is an elephant. Your father takes care of bulls, too? I didn't know there were cows in the circus.
He laughed.
No, we call the elephants bulls. Doesn't matter if they're girls or boys.
Oh, Lily said. She had to think about that. She edged toward the baby and placed a gentle hand on its wide gray head. Short black hairs bristled from the top of its forehead like a stiff brush. Lily's heart filled with wonder and delight, and something that felt like joy. Her cheeks hurt from smiling so much. She never thought she'd have the chance to touch a real live elephant, let alone a baby elephant.
This is Jojo, the boy said.
The baby curled his trunk around Lily's arm and pulled her closer. She laughed again.
Wow, the boy said. He really likes you.
Lily ran her free hand over the edge of Jojo's ear, amazed at the warmth and softness of his thick skin. The boy rubbed Jojo's temples and forehead.
They like to be petted here, he said, and on their trunk.
Lily rubbed Jojo's trunk, which was still wrapped around her arm, then ran her hand up and down between his eyes.
All right, Jojo, the boy said. That's enough, let her go.
The baby unfurled its trunk and moved beneath his mother, rubbing its little ears on her legs. Lily couldn't take her eyes off him.
Come on, the boy said. I'll introduce you to the others.
He slipped beneath the rope and made his way to the next elephant. Lily followed.
This is Petunia. She's 24, the boy said. And the one on the end is Flossie, Jojo's aunt. She's the oldest of the group at 63 and the biggest. Mr. Barlow claims she's 3 inches bigger than Jumbo.
He grinned at Lily.
And I'm Cole.
She glanced down at her shoes.
I'm Lily.
Nice to meet you, Lily.
He kicked stray piles of hay closer to Flossie, then rubbed her trunk.
What is he thinking? She wondered. Is he going to ask why I'm so white and how I ended up in the circus?
So, what were you...
She started.
Why were you laying in the hay with Pepper and Jojo?
He shrugged.
I like to be with them. It helps me think. Sometimes my father lets me sleep in their stock car.
Lily's eyes grew wide.
They don't step on you?
He shook his head.
Nah, they're used to me.
You're lucky.
She slipped under the rope and moved closer to Flossie.
I just wish they didn't...
Didn't what?
I wish they didn't have to be chained.
Cole frowned.
I know, but my dad said it's for their own good.
He ducked beneath Flossie to scratch her belly.
If they got loose and got into trouble, who knows what would happen? Someone might hurt them. People get mad at animals for acting like animals all the time.
Something cold and sad twisted in Lily's chest. Mama said the bars on her bedroom window were there for her own good, too. And Merrick said if she ran away, someone would hurt her because of the color of her skin, something that wasn't her fault. It seemed like she had more in common with the circus animals than the people. No wonder she could feel their pain.
If you want, you can come see the elephants whenever I'm here, Cole said. Just don't let Mr. Barlow or the trainers catch you.
Lily couldn't believe what she was hearing.
Really?
Sure.
Just stay away from the other animals. I haven't spent as much time with them, so I'm not sure which ones to trust.
She fought the urge to jump up and down, glad he was still scratching Flossie so he wouldn't see her excited grin.
Okay, thanks.
Just then, the tent entrance flapped open and someone came into the menagerie. Lily stood rooted to the ground, trying to decide if she should run or hide under the elephant with Cole.
Hey!
A man yelled. He marched toward her, his face angry. What are you doing in here? Cole scrambled out from beneath Flossie, crawled under the rope, and stood in the aisle.
It's okay, Dad, he said. She's my friend.
Lily felt a strange flutter in her belly. Cole had called her his friend. And he said she could spend more time with the elephants. It seemed almost too good to be true. Chapter 12, Julia. The day after going into the den and finding the locked drawer and her high school photo on her father's desk, Julia made her way up to the third floor, hoping to find a way into the attic. She needed to figure out how the rats were getting in before the infestation got any worse. With Mother's keys on her belt loop, she hurried up the second flight of stairs, something she hadn't done since she was a little girl. When she used to stomp up and down the steps to see how many times she could get away with it before Mother scolded her for forgetting the third floor was off limits. Except for the thick coating of dust and cobwebs hanging from the crown moldings and ceiling lights, the layout was the same as the second floor, with a wood-paneled grid of hallways lined with red Turkish runners, brass sconces, and closed doors. Starting at the far end of the main hall, Julia stuck her head inside each soundless room, unable to shake the feeling that she was in an abandoned hotel. Every tight, narrow chamber was exactly the same, with double windows, a mahogany bed, a mirrored dresser, a dust-covered duvet, and a red and green Tiffany lamp on a bedside table. She had no memories of visitors heading up to there to sleep, and could barely recall her parents having company. She also had no knowledge of the history of Blackwood, if it had been in the family before her parents owned it, or the age of the building. As a child, she hadn't cared. But now, it was easy to imagine a time when elaborate feasts and grand parties were held in the dining room and the sweeping front lawn, couples dancing and drinking before treading upstairs arm in arm to make love in the beds or to argue, laugh, and cry within the privacy of the third-floor rooms. She pictured lovers meeting secretly, couples fighting, men taking advantage of women, drunks being put to bed, women weeping in chairs next to windows, men playing cards and smoking. It was quite possible that someone, maybe more than one someone, had died up here. Could it be that rats weren't the ones making noises at night? Could it be that Blackwood Manor was full of ghosts? The idea made her shiver. She pushed the morbid thoughts away and walked to the end of each hall, looking for a way up to the attic. If rats were getting in somewhere, the attic would be the logical place for them to hide. She searched for another door or staircase, but found none. She checked the ceilings for a trap door. Still no luck. It didn't make sense. How did her parents get up to the top floor? Thinking she had missed something the first time, she looked in every room again. Then, in the bedroom at the end of the last hall, she noticed there were two closet doors instead of one. She hurried toward it, then slowed. What if she found a nest full of rats in the attic? Or a loft full of bats? With a strange mixture of excitement and fear, she opened the first door. It was a closet, empty except for a dusty pair of men's dress shoes with crumbling laces. When she slowly opened the second door and peered inside, the light from the bedroom revealed a narrow space the size of a large bathroom or small dressing room, decorated with wainscoting and fleur-de-lis wallpaper. Haphazard piles of hat boxes and shoe boxes lined one wall. She opened the door all the way and let out a screech. A nude, headless woman stood in the back corner, partially obscured by the shadows. Then Julia realized her mistake and laughed, her fingers over her mouth. It was a dressmaker's dummy. She stepped through the door, pulled a string on a bare bulb, and the room flooded with gray light. Unlike the 8-foot ceilings in the rest of the house, the ceiling in the small room was less than 6 feet tall, and if she stretched out her arms, she could touch two walls at the same time. At the far end of the space, next to the dummy, a hand-carved table with lion legs atop ball and claw feet sat beneath a cloth tapestry, embroidered with a stone cottage surrounded by iris and lilies. Why anyone would hang a tapestry in such a small room was beyond her. She put her hands on her hips and glanced around. What had this room been used for? It felt chillier than the rest of the house, and she couldn't imagine why. Maybe it had been someone's private sitting area or changing room. It almost seemed like a hidden chamber. A hidden chamber for what? Who knew? She picked up one of the hat boxes and blew a layer of dust off the lid. Just as she was about to open it, someone called her name downstairs. It was either Claude or Fletcher. She couldn't tell which. She switched off the light, left the room, closed the bedroom door, and hurried toward the staircase. Claude waited at the bottom, his face dark. Julia stopped on the top step, surprised to see him in the house, let alone on the second floor. "What is it?" she said.
"Sorry for barging in unannounced," he said, sounding winded. "I knocked, but no one answered."
"I was in one of the bedrooms. What's going on?"
"We need to call Fletcher. One of the mares is falling."
She started down the steps. "The phone is in the kitchen." Claude hurried down the stairs, and Julia followed. He ran into the kitchen and went straight to the phone on the counter next to the pantry door. She couldn't help noticing he knew where to find it. He dialed the number and waited, his hat twisted in his fist. His wind-reddened brow furrowed. Without saying hello or announcing who he was, he said, "Bonnie Blue's in trouble." Julia drew in a sharp breath, then rushed into the mudroom and put on boots and a jacket.
"All right," Claude said, and hung up the phone.
He put on his hat and marched toward the door.
"Is he coming?" Julia said.
"He's half hour away," Claude said, "and he might be too late."
He yanked open the door and went out. She followed.
"Is there anything I can do to help?"
Claude said nothing and sprinted across the lawn. Julia did her best to keep up. It started to snow. In the barn, Bonnie Blue lay on her side in the straw, panting, her neck and sides wet with sweat. The other horses nickered and whinnied and thumped against their stalls, sensing something was wrong. Julia stood in the doorway of Bonnie Blue's stall and watched Claude. Unable to stop the trembling that worked its way up and down her limbs.
"Is there anything I can do?" she said.
"Nope," Claude said.
He moved straw out from around Blue's backside with his foot and lifted her tail. A small white hoof stuck out beneath her tail, like a child's fist wrapped in white plastic.
"What's wrong with her?"
"Her labor's taken too long," Claude said. "That foal should be out by now, and Blue's getting weak. I checked to see if the foal was turned wrong, but I can't tell. It's too big."
Julia could hardly breathe. If that beautiful horse and her foal died, she wasn't sure she could take it. Not just because Blue and her foal were her responsibility now, and she already felt a special connection to them, but because horses had always seemed so strong and majestic to her, like they were supposed to live forever. Seeing a horse die, a pregnant one at that, would be a tragedy from which she wasn't sure she'd recover. And if this was going to be her initiation into the ownership of Blackwood Manor Horse Farm, maybe she should give up now.
"Is it okay if I come in?" she said.
"Sure barn," Claude said.
She entered the stall, and stepping carefully around Blue, knelt beside her head.
"Shh," she said. "Everything's going to be all right."
With gentle fingers, she pushed Blue's forelock away from her eyes and rubbed her forehead slowly, hoping to distract her from pain. Blue moved her head ever so slightly in Julia's direction and nickered softly. Julia's eyes filled and a burning lump formed in her throat. It seemed like Blue recognized her. Waiting for Fletcher, Claude paced the stall, his hands and fists, and every few minutes checked under Blue's tail. Julia blinked back tears and kept stroking Blue's forehead and ears, talking to her in a soothing voice. Every now and then, Blue closed her eyes, her breathing slowed, and Julia's heart nearly stopped. After what seemed like an eternity, the barn door opened and slammed shut, and Fletcher ran up the aisle.
"What's going on?" he said out of breath. "I think the foal's too big," Claude said. "Either that or something else is wrong."
Fletcher came into the stall, rolled up his sleeves, and felt Blue's stomach. Then he went around to her rear end, knelt, and pushed her tail aside.
"One of the foal's front legs is back too far."
He pulled on the little hoof and let it go back in, sliding his fingers in beside it.
"It's okay, Blue," he said in a calming voice. "You'll be all right. Just hold on a little longer."
Slowly, he put his hand inside the mare, waited a second, then gently pushed his arm in almost up to his elbow. Blue stiffened and groaned.
"Hold her hind legs," he said to Claude.
Claude got into position, and Fletcher looked at Julia with serious eyes.
"Do you think you can hold her head down?"
Julia nodded.
"Get between her crest and withers and firmly put your hands on the side of her neck beneath her mane," Fletcher said. "This is going to be painful, so she might try to stand and we need to keep her down. Don't worry, you won't hurt her.
Julia went around the top of Blue's head and knelt beside her neck.
Ready?
Fletcher said.
Yep,
Claude said. Julia nodded again, sweat breaking out on her forehead. Fletcher pushed his arm in farther, and Blue's body contracted in pain. She grunted and panted and moaned.
It's okay,
Julia whispered to Blue, holding her neck down with both hands.
You're gonna be all right. We're trying to help.
Fletcher grimaced and reached in farther. He felt around for what seemed like forever, then finally said, "Got it," and started slowly pulling. Blue stiffened and snorted loudly, nostrils flaring. Little by little, Fletcher's arm came out all the way, the full second hoof in his fist. Suddenly, Blue went limp, exhausted.
"Let her go,"
Fletcher ordered Julia and Claude. Julia lifted her hands, and Claude released Blue's back legs. Still gripping the second hoof, Fletcher grabbed the first hoof with his other hand and pulled.
"Come on, Blue, push," he yelled.
Blue's belly contracted, and she lifted her head and pushed while Fletcher pulled. The foal's hooves and front legs came out up to its knees, and Claude broke the white bag around them and yanked it away so Fletcher could get a better grip. Then the foal's head came out, and Blue went limp again. Fletcher kept pulling while Claude drew away more of the white sack from around the foal's eyes and mouth.
"Come on, Blue," Julia whispered. "You can do it."
Blue moved her head. Her stomach contracted again. And finally, Fletcher pulled the foal out all the way. He let go and stood while Claude drew away the rest of the sack. The wet foal lay in the straw, its sides fluttering up and down, its head down, its neck limp. It was oil black like Blue, with perfect white socks halfway up to its tiny knees, but its ribs stuck out. It looked half starved, and it wasn't moving. Julia swallowed and knelt in the straw, certain the foal was dying. Bonnie Blue and her foal lay tail to tail in the stall, both motionless except for quick, shallow gulps of air. Julia's heartbeat thudded in her brain, like her veins were about to burst. She felt like she couldn't breathe or speak or move. How could this be happening? How could these beautiful horses, a mother and her newborn baby, be dying? To her horror and shock, Fletcher and Claude seemed unfazed. If this was what it was like to own Blackwood Farm, she didn't want any part of it. Fletcher checked between the foal's hind legs. "It's a filly." Julia looked at him and waited for the bad news, amazed he could be so detached. He was a veterinarian, trained to save sick and injured animals. Why was he just standing there? Then, to her surprise, the filly rolled onto its belly and lifted its head. Its long limbs stretched out like saplings. But even if it survived, she thought, how would it ever stand on such bone-thin legs? It seemed impossible. The filly's head doddered like an old man's, as if taking one first and final look at the world. Julia couldn't take it. She looked at Blue, who still lay on her side, her eyes closed.
"Oh, God, not you too."
Hot tears fell down Julia's cheeks. Then Blue lifted her head, rolled onto her belly, and curled her legs beneath her. The filly lifted its tiny wet head higher, then glanced at its mother and inched forward in the straw, struggling to get closer to her. Blue gazed back at her filly and nickered. The filly inched toward her, every effort a little bit stronger. And then Julie recognized the look in their eyes, the look she had studied so many times between mothers and daughters, the look that lit up their faces with affection and recognition of their unconditional love. Her breath caught in her chest.
"Well, Miss Blackwood," Fletcher said, smiling at her. "What's your new filly's name?"
Even Claude was smiling. Julia put a hand over her mouth to stifle a sob. Miraculously, Blue and her filly were going to be okay. Chapter 13. Lily. 1937. Lily lay on her bunk inside the stifling hot car, staring into the darkness and listening to the other sideshow women mumble and snore in their sleep. She was on top of her covers, her cotton nightgown pulled up to her thighs, her long hair piled above her head on the pillow. The train had stopped a few hours ago, and she had been with the circus long enough to know that the smell of bacon, eggs, fried potatoes, and strong coffee meant the flying squadron, the first section of the train to arrive in town, had already set up the cook tent. The roustabouts were laying out the lot. Cole's father, his name was Hank, and the rest of the menagerie workers were feeding hay and grain to the animals, and the cooks were getting ready to serve the first meal of the day, made from meat, vegetables, flour, milk, sugar, and butter delivered earlier that morning, to the hundreds of workers and performers employed by the Barlow Brothers' most amazing show on earth. Despite the fact that the inside of the sleeper car felt like an oven, and her horsehair mattress was full of lumps, she was grateful for both. She'd been sharing this car with the other women for the past 4 years, and she had Glory to thank for it. Because when Lily turned 12, Glory gave Merrick a choice. Either he allowed Lily to move out, or she would leave him. Lily knew Glory was doing it to protect her, but she never thought it would work. At first, Glory tried convincing Merrick it was an issue of privacy. But by that point, Lily had already spent 2 years on the couch listening to them in the bedroom, talking and arguing and laughing. The first time she heard them having sex, she put a pillow over her head and cried, certain Merrick was hurting Glory, but too terrified to do anything about it. When Glory came out of the bedroom the next morning, she saw the worried look on Lily's face. She assured her that she and Merrick had only been playing a game, and she was fine. Then Lily walked in on them naked one afternoon, and Glory gave her the talk about the birds and the bees. After that, Lily put her head under the pillow every night, just in case. So when Glory told Merrick she was worried Lily might catch them doing something inappropriate, he laughed. It was already too late for that. But then Glory packed her bags and stood in the doorway with tears in her eyes, and Merrick surprised everyone by letting Lily move out. He still kept a close eye on her, threatening to send her away if she messed up, talking to her like she was a possession instead of a person. But she was no longer a regular victim of his physical abuse. When she was living with him, the slightest slip-up or wrong word set him off, and he kept control with insults, the backside of his hand, and sometimes his fists. Lily tried talking Glory into leaving with her, but for some reason Glory refused. Half the sideshow performers said Glory stayed with Merrick because she thought she could change him. The other half said it was because he saved her brother, Victor, from a lifetime in an asylum. After Lily moved out, she asked Glory nearly every day if she was okay. Sometimes Glory looked happy and acted fine, and other times she seemed sad and distant. On the days when she was quiet, she wore more makeup than usual, or combed her hair in a different way to hide the bruises. Lily eventually realized Glory loved Merrick, despite the way he treated her. And sadly, she knew what it was like to care about someone who misused you. Even after everything Mama and Daddy had done to her, the fact that they never returned her love still broke her heart. Now everyone would be getting up soon, and the other sideshow performers in the car, Dolly, the world's most beautiful fat woman, Cece, the snake enchantress, Hester, the monkey girl, and Penelope, the singing midget, would be climbing down from their beds, asking one another what town they were in today. After all, it was easy to forget, considering the Barlow Brothers Circus covered 15,000 miles and 150 shows every season. Lily knew two things for sure. They were somewhere in Pennsylvania, and when Merrick returned from scouting out new venues for the past week, he was going to have it out for her again. Even now, despite the fact that she'd been with the sideshow 6 years and was one of his star attractions, the money she brought in was his to keep. He was her boss and legal guardian, and 3 meals a day and a place to sleep was all he owed her. She asked 100 times to be paid like the other performers, but he always reminded her that he could get rid of her as easily as he had acquired her. This time, though, she was going to be in trouble for turning away a line of townies, or, as she now called them, rubes. And that was one thing you didn't do. You didn't get between Merrick and his take, especially when you were one of his main acts, the albino medium. Not to mention she had broken the golden rule, the show must go on. Merrick came up with the idea for the albino medium after he convinced Mr. Barlow that the rubes were more interested in Dina the living half-girl and Mabel the four-legged woman than the ice princess from another planet. And Alana loved the concept so much, she wanted to help with the act and persuaded Mr. Barlow to give Lily her own tent. At first, Lily thought being the albino medium would be better than being in the freak show, where the rubes stared and heckled and spit at her, toddlers cried out in fright, and little old ladies tried poking her with canes. Kids and adults alike threw popcorn and peanuts and half-eaten candy apples at her, laughing when she ducked, hooting when something hit her. And when Merrick put her out front to lure rubes into the tent, women touched her face, drunk men grabbed her chest, and teenagers pulled her waist-long hair. More than one tried to yank it out. But after the first few weeks of her new act, she grew to hate the fact that people thought she was real, and she felt horrible seeing rubes part with their hard-earned money in the hopes of hearing from a deceased family member on the other side. Some people were so desperate they paid with jewelry, or what looked like their last dollar. Sure, there were a lot of fake acts in the sideshow. The devil baby, the Fiji mermaid, the woman with two heads. But that didn't make her feel any better. Day after day of countless pained faces, all of them looking at her with hope and enthusiasm, praying to hear from deceased mothers, fathers, lovers, children, was almost more than she could bear. How long had it been since the first clueless rube had come into the albino medium's tent and asked to speak to a departed loved one? 2 years? 3? It felt like 100. Thinking about it now, as she lay in her bunk alone with her thoughts, anguish welled up inside her chest. But she fought it and pushed it back down, packing it away. It was better to be numb. And yet, she wasn't numb. She felt like one of the lions or elephants, a caged animal being forced to perform. She used to work the gig on the same schedule as the rest of the sideshow, but then the lines grew longer and longer, and some of the rubes willingly missed part of the big top to see her. Now, her tent was open all day, from the opening of the doors to the final curtain, with 2 short breaks to rest and have a meal. At the end of those long days, her emotions were spent, and the only thing that made her feel better was spending time in the menagerie. If it were up to her, she would have gotten a job with Hank, taking care of the bulls, mucking out stalls, filling water in feed buckets, giving them treats and patting their trunks, the smallest and perhaps only bit of comfort they would find in the circus. The circus trainers and performers claimed to love the animals, but as soon as the show was over, they put them back in their stalls and cages and forgot about them until the next performance. Sure, the animals were fed and housed and examined by a vet if they were hurt or ill, but Lily and Cole were the only ones who talked to them, played with them, and gave them extra scratches and rubs, and they did it every night. Last night in the menagerie, when she told Cole she had turned away the line of rubes, he begged her to hide in his car until Merrick cooled off, but she refused. It wouldn't be fair to get him involved. He was her best friend, and everyone knew it and accepted it, maybe because they had been children when it first began. But that meant if Merrick didn't find Lily in her car, Cole's car would be the first place he'd look. Now, she wondered if she'd made a mistake. Maybe she should have taken Cole up on his offer. At least he'd be there to protect her. Part of her hoped no one would tell Merrick, but she knew better. Anyone who held back that information would be in trouble, too. And then there was Victor, whose loyalty rested with Merrick no matter how badly he treated his sister Glory. Everyone had warned Lily over the years never to badmouth Merrick in front of Victor, or to do anything that might affect Merrick's bottom line. Now she wondered if Victor would be the first one to tell Merrick what she had done. The other women said they couldn't blame her for shutting down her act, but she knew it wouldn't matter to Merrick. Thinking about it now, she could hardly believe what happened. To trick the rubes waiting to see the albino medium, Alana went down the line with a ledger and wrote down the name of the departed loved one each rube hoped to reach, in the guise of a money-back guarantee. She only did a few at a time because the waiting area tent next to the albino medium's tent only held 10 people. But unbeknownst to the rubes, Alana wrote the names down twice, once in her ledger and again on another slip of paper, which she moved to her pocket unseen. And if the rube was a mark, a townie with a fat wallet, singled out by the ticket seller with a friendly slap on the back that left a chalk mark, it was noted on the paper too, so Lily could offer a more in-depth reading for an extra charge. After ushering 10 rubes into the waiting area, Alana transferred the list to Merrick, who gave the names to Lily one at a time. Sometimes when Merrick was gone, Leon, the old man who found her locked in the animal cage all those years ago, took his place. The inside of the albino medium's tent was decorated with red and black curtains, shiny beads, mirrors, and dark rugs. The only light came from 3 candles in pewter holders on a round antique table in the middle of the tent, with 2 chairs on either side. One an elaborately carved throne for Lily, the other a cane-backed chair for the rube. Pierre, a midget who used to work as a clown until he broke his pelvis during the Baby in a Burning Building act, hid inside a wardrobe with sliding panels where he could clap, whistle, or play the harmonica or tambourine without being seen. Sometimes he snuck out of his hiding place to touch the rubes with wool-stuffed evening gloves, or to produce a glowing light or other moving object in the dark, like a woman's hanky on the end of a stick. Other times, a spirit baby, a stuffed shape concealed beneath the tabletop and attached to a stick worked by Lily's foot, peered over the edge of the table when called from the netherworld. And when Lily asked a spirit to ring the bell beneath a glass globe in the center of the table, Pierre rang a bell inside the wardrobe. It was a clever setup, and word quickly spread that the albino medium was authentic. But every time the bell rang, or the tambourine jingled, every time Lily relayed a special message from the great beyond, and the grieving person's facial expressions changed from sadness to surprise, from doubt to gratitude, guilt clawed at her throat. It was a lie, all of it. And seeing the rubes' tear-stained faces broke her heart. It was late yesterday afternoon when a strange-acting man came into the tent. His hands stuffed in his jacket pockets, a wool scarf over his mouth, his hat pulled down over his forehead. At first, Lily thought wearing a scarf in the middle of summer seemed odd. Then she reminded herself that she had done readings for a woman in bathing trunks, an old lady dressed like a gypsy, and someone in a chicken costume. She had seen men in women's skirts, toddlers wearing cat ears, and boys with earrings. Nothing surprised her anymore. She gestured for the man to sit down across from her and thought briefly how the scarf did little to hide the smell of alcohol on his breath. Then, like a trained animal, she began her spiel in a low, even voice. "Hello and welcome. Before we begin, let me tell you a little bit about what I do. I've been communicating with the dead since the age of 4, and eventually came to realize I needed to share my gift. Messages from the beyond can come in the form of music, voices and other sounds. What I'd like you to do is close your eyes and think about the person you're hoping to hear.